and crossed them, maybe as if signaling for distant aid. This made X's and pedantive V's over much of the city Tucson. Still, Raimi, but born in the hated by you Ottawa, this civilian attaché, and connected to a major buyer of Transgrid Entertainment, and follow up out of the Boston office's reports, possible indications of the victim's prior possible involvement with the widow of the auteur we both know was responsible for the entertainment in the first place.
The samizdat.
Prior? Steeply produced from his handbag, Belgian cigarettes, of a many-millimeter and habitually female type.
Film director's wife had taught out at Brandeis where the victim had done his residency. The husband was on board over at AEC. The different agencies' background checks indicated the wife was fucking just about everything with a pulse.
With a slight pause of which Steeply could excel, particularly a Canadian pulse.
Involvement of sexuality is what you are meaning then, not politics?
Steeply said, this wife herself a Quebecer, Raimi, from Lillay County. Chief Tyne says 3 years spent on Ottawa's personne qui en droit list. There's such a thing as political sex.
I have said to you all we know. Civilians, as individual warnings to ONAN, are not our desire. This is known by you.
Murat's eyes looked nearly closed.
And your teats, they have become cockeyed, I will tell you. Services without specificity, they have given you ridiculous teats. And now they point differently.
Steeply looked down at himself. One of the false breasts, surely false. Surely they would not go as far as the hormonal, Murat thought, nearly touched the chins of Steeply when his looking down produced his double chins.
I was asked to secure personal verification is all, he said. My general sense at the office is the brass consider the whole incident a stumper. There are theories and counter-theories. There are even anti-theories, positing error, mistaken identity, sick hoax.
His shrugging with his hands on the prosthesis appeared not at all Gallic.
Still, 23 human beings lost for all time.
That'd be some hoax, no?
Murat sniffed.
Asked to verify by our mutual Monsieur Tyne? How you call him, Rod a God?
Rodney Tyne Sr., Chief of Unspecified Services, acknowledged architect of ONAN and Continental Reconfiguration, who held the ear of the White House of USA,
and whose stenographer had long doubled as the stenographer cum jeune fille de vendredi
of Monsieur Duplessis, former assistant coordinator of the Pan-Canadian Resistance, and whose passionate, ill-disguised attachment, Tynes, to this double amanuensis, one Mademoiselle Luria Perec of Lamartine, County Lillet, Quebec, gave rise to these questions of the high-level loyalties of Tyne, whether he doubled for Quebec out of the love for Luria, or tripled the loyalties, pretending only to divulge secrets, while secretly maintaining his USA fealty against the pull of an irresistible love, it was said.
41.
The Raimi.
It was clear that Steeply could not fix his breasts directions without pulling down severely his décolletage, which he was shy to do. He produced from his handbag sunglasses and put on the sunglasses. They were embellished with rhinestones and looked absurd.
Rod the God.
Murat forced himself to say nothing of their appearance. Steeply tried with several matches to light a cigarette in the wind. The encroachment of true dusk began to erase his wig's chaotic shadow.
Electric lights began to twinkle in the Rincon foothills east of the city.
Steeply tried somewhat to cup his body around the match, for shelter for the flame. It's a herd of feral hamsters. A major herd, thundering across the yellow plains of the southern reaches of the Great Concavity in what used to be Vermont, raising dust that forms a uremic-hued cloud, with somatic shapes interpretable from as far away as Boston and Montreal. The herd is descended from two domestic hamsters set free by a Watertown, New York boy at the beginning of the experialist migration in the subsidized year of the Whopper. The boy now attends college in Champaign, Illinois, and has forgotten that his hamsters were named Ward and June. The noise of the herd is tornadic, locomotival. The expression on the hamster's whiskered faces is businesslike and implacable. It's that implacable herd expression. They thunder eastward across pedulphorous terrain that today is fallow, denuded. To the east, dimmed by the fulvous cloud the hamsters send up, is the vivid, verdant, ragged outline of the annularly over-fertilized forests of what used to be central Maine. All these territories are now property of Canada. With respect to a herd of this size, please exercise the sort of common sense that, come to think of it, would keep your thinking man out of the Southwest concavity anyway. Feral hamsters are not pets. They mean business. Wide berth advised. Carry nothing even remotely vegetable-ish if in the path of a feral herd. If in the path of such a herd, move quickly and calmly in a direction perpendicular to their own. If American, north, not advisable. Move south, calmly, and in all haste, toward some border metropolis. Rome, New New York, or Glen Falls, New New York, or Beverly, Massachusetts, say, or those bordered points between them, at which the giant protective ATHSCME fans atop the hugely convex protective walls of anodized lucite hold off the drooling and piss-colored bank of teratogenic concavity clouds and move the bank well back, north, away, jaggedly, over your protected head. The heavily tongued English of Steeply was even more difficult to understand with a cigarette in his mouth. He said,
"And of course you report this little interface of you and me right back to Fortier."
Marat shrugged.
"Bien sûr."
Steeply got it lit. He was a large and soft man, some type of brutal U.S. contact sport athlete now become fat. He appeared to Marat to look less like a woman than a twisted parody of womanhood. Electrolysis had caused patches of tiny red pimples along his jowls and upper lip. He also held his elbow out, the arm holding the match for lighting, which is how no woman lights a cigarette. He was used to breasts and keeps the lighting elbow in. Also, Steeply teetered ungracefully on his pump's heels on the stone's uneven surface. He never for a moment turned his back completely at Marat as he stood on the lip of the outcropping. And Marat had his chair's wheels clamps now locked down tight and a firm grip on the machine pistol's pebbled grip. Steeply's purse was small and glossy black, and the sunglasses he wore had womanly frames with small false jewels at the temples. Marat believed that something in Steeply enjoyed his grotesque appearance and craved the humiliation of the field disguises his BSS superiors requested of him. Steeply now looked at him, improbability behind the dark glasses.
"And also that I just right now asked you if you'd report it and that you said, bien sûr?"
Marat's laugh had this misfortune to sound false and overhearty, whether or not sincere. He made a mustache of his finger, pretending for some reason to stifle a need to sneeze.
"You verify this because of why?"
Steeply scratched under the hem of his blonde wig, with, stupidly, dangerously, the thumb of his hand that held the cigarette.
"Well, you are already tripling, Raimi, aren't you? Or would it be quadrupling? We know 40A and the AFR know you're here with me now.
But do my brothers on wheels know that you are knowing this? That they have sent me to pretend a devil?"
Marat's sidearm, a sterling UL-35 9mm machine pistol with a Magnaport silencer, did not have a safety. Its fat and texture of pebbles grip was hot from Marat's palm, and in turn caused Marat's palm to perspire beneath the blanket. From Steeply, there merely was silence. Marat said,
"Have I merely pretended to pretend to pretend to betray?"
42.
And the desert USA's light had become now sad, more than half the round sun gone behind the tortellitas. Only now the chair's wheels and Steeply's thick legs cast shadows below the desk line, and these shadows were becoming squat and retreating back up toward the two men. Steeply did a brief pretend Charleston, playing with his legs' shadows.
Nothing personal, you know that. It's the obsessive caution. Who was it? Who once said, we get paid to drive ourselves crazy, the caution thing. You guys, and Tyne. Your Duplessis always suspected he tried to hold back on the information he passed sexually to Luria.
Orant shrugged hard.
And abruptly, Monsieur Duplessis has now passed away from life, under circumstances of almost ridiculous suspicion.
Again with the false-sounding laugh.
An inept burglary, and grief indeed.
Both men were silent. Steeply's left arm had on it a nasty mesquite scratch, Marat could observe. Marat finally glanced at his watch, its dial illuminated in his body's shadow. Both men's shadows were now climbing the steep incline, returning up to them.
Me? I think that we go about our affairs in a more simple manner than your BSS office. If Monsieur Tyne's betrayal were incomplete, we of Quebec would be aware.
Because of Luria.
Marat pretended to fuss with his blanket, rearranging it.
But yes, the caution. Luria would be aware.
Steeply stepped gingerly up to the edge and tossed out his cigarette stub. The wind caught the stub and it soared slightly upward from his hand, moving east. Both men were silent until the butt fell and hit the dark mountainside off below them, a tiny bloom of orange. Their silence then became contemplative. Something tight in the air between them loosened. Marat no longer felt the sun on his skull. Dusk settled about them. Steeply had found his triceps scratch and twisted the flesh of his arm to examine it, his rouged lips rounded with concern. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Tuesday, the 3rd of November, Enfield Tennis Academy. AM drills, shower, eat, class, lab, class, class, eat, prescriptive grammar exam, lab/class, conditioning run, PM drills, play challenge match, upper body circuits in weight room, sauna, shower, slumped locker room floor with other players.
To even realize what they're sitting there feeling is unhappiness? Or to even feel it in the first place?
1640 hours, the ComAd building's male's locker room is full of clean upperclassmen in towels after PM matches. The players' hair, wet-combed and shining with barbicide. Pemulus uses the comb's big-toothed end to get that wide furrowed look that kids from Alston favor. Hal's own hair tends to look wet-combed even when it's dry.
So, Jim Trulch says, looking around, so, what do you think?
Pemulus lowers himself to the floor by the sinks, leaning up against the cabinet where they keep all the disinfectants. He has this way of looking warily to either side of him before he says anything.
Was there like a central point to all that, Trulch?
The exam was talking about the syntax of Tolstoy's sentence, not about real and happy families, Hal says quietly. John Wayne, as do most Canadians, lifts one leg slightly to fart.
Like the fart was some kind of task.
Standing at his locker, waiting for his feet to get dry enough to put on socks. There is a silence. Showerheads dribble on tile. Steam hangs. Distant, ghastly sounds from tea shocked over in one of the stalls of the showers. Everyone stares into the middle distance, stunned with fatigue. Michael Pemulus, who can stand about 10 seconds of communal silence, tops, clears his throat deeply and sends a loogie up and back into the sink behind him. The plate mirrors caught part of its quivering flight, Hal sees. Hal closes his eyes.
Tired, someone exhales.
Ortho Stice and John N.R. Wayne seem less fatigued than detached. They have the really top player's way of shutting the whole neural net down for brief periods, staring at the space they took up, hooded in silence, removed for a moment from the connectedness of all events.
Right then, Trolch says. Pop quiz. Pop test question. Most crucial difference for Leith tomorrow between your historical broadcast TV set and a cartridge-capable TP.
Disney R. Leith teaches ETA's History of Entertainment 1 and 2, as well as certain high-level esoteric optics things you needed permission of the Institute to get into.
The cathode luminescent panel.
No, cathode gun.
No.
Phosphenic screen. 2 to the screen's diagonal width in centimeter lines of resolution total.
You mean a high-def viewer in general, or a specifically TP component viewer?
No analogs, Strzok says. No snow, no faint weird like ghostly double necks to UHF images. No vertical roll when planes fly over.
Analogs versus digitals.
You referring to broadcast as a network versus a TP, or network plus cable versus a TP?
Did cable TV use analogs?
What, like pre-fiber phones?
It's the digitals. Leith has that word he uses for the shift from analogs to digitals, that word he uses about 11 times an hour.
What did pre-fiber phones use exactly?
The old tin can and string principle.
Seminal. He keeps saying it. Seminal, seminal.
The biggest advance in home communications since the phone, he says.
In home entertainment since the TV itself.
Leith might say the right capable CD for entertainment.
He's hard to pin down if you get him on entertainment qua entertainment.
The Dizzle say use your own judgment, Pemula says. Axford took it last year. He wants an argument made. He'll skewer you if you treat it like there's an obvious answer.
Plus there's the interlace de-digitizer instead of an antenna with a TP.
Jim Strzok says, squeezing at something behind his ear.
Graham Yardguard Raider is checking his underarm for more hair. Freer and Shaw might be asleep.
Stice has pulled his towel down slightly and is fingering the deep red abdominal stripe a jock's waistband leaves.
Boys, I ever become president, the first thing to go's elastic.
Trolch pretends to shuffle cards.
Next item. Next, like flashcard, huh? Define acuteness. Anybody?
A measure of resolution directly proportional to the resolved ratio of a given pulse's digital code, Hal says.
The inkster has the last word once again, says Strzok, which invites a chorus. The Halster. Halorama. Halation.
Halation, Raider says. A halo-shaped exposure pattern around light sources seen on chemical film at low speed. That most angelic of distortions. Strzok says,
we'll be like vying for the seats all around ink tomorrow.
Hal shuts his eyes. He can see the page of text right there, all highlighted, all yellowed up.
He can scan the page, rotate it, fold the corner down, and clean under his nails with it, all mentally.
Leave him alone, Pemula says. Freer opens his eyes.
Do a dictionary page for us, man. Ink?
Stice says, leave him be.
It's all only half nasty. Hal is placid about getting his balls smacked around.
They all are.
He does his share of chops busting.
Some of the littler kids who take their showers after the upperclassmen are hanging around, listening. Hal sits on the floor, quiescent, chin on his chest, just thinking it's nice finally to breathe and get enough air. The temperature had fallen with the sun. Marat listened to the cooler evening wind roll across the incline and desert floor.
Nor I could sense or feel many million floral pores begin slowly to open, hopeful of dew. The American, steeply, produced small exhalations between his teeth as he examined his scratch of the arm. Only one or two remaining tips of the digitate spikes of the radial blades of the sun found crevices between the Tortolitas peaks and probed at the roof of the sky. There were the slight and dry, locationless rustlings of small living things that wished to come out at night, emerging. The sky was violet. Everyone in the locker rooms got a towel around his waist, like a kilt. Everyone except Stice has a white ETA towel. Stice uses his own sort of trademark towels, black ones. After a silence, Stice shoots some air out through his nose. Jim Strzok picks liberally at his face and neck. There are one or two sighs. Peter Beek and Evan Ingersoll and Kent Blott. 12, 11, 10 are up sitting on the blonde wood benches that run in front of the lockers' rows, sitting there in towels, elbows on knees, not taking part.
So was Zoltan Chikmensihai,
who's 16 but speaks very little English. Idris Arslanian, new this year, ethnically vague, 14, all feet and teeth, is a shadowy lurking presence just outside the locker room door, poking the non-caucasoid snout in occasionally, and then withdrawing, terribly shy. Each ETA player in 18 and unders has like 4 to 6 14 and unders kids he's supposed to keep his more experienced wing over, look out for. The more the ETA administration trusts you, the younger and more generally clueless the little kids in your charge. Charles Tavis instituted the practice and calls it the Big Buddy System in the literature he sends new kids' parents. So the parents can feel their kids not getting lost in the institutional shuffle. Beek, Blott, and Arslanian are all in Hal's Big Buddy group for YDAU. He also in effect has Ingersoll, having traded Todd, Postlethwaite, to Axford off the books for Ingersoll because Trevor Axford found he so despised the Ingersoll kid for some unanalyzable reason that he was struggling against a horrible compulsion to put Ingersoll's little fingers into the gap by the hinges of an open door and then very slowly close the door, and came to Hal almost in tears. Axford had. Though technically Ingersoll is still Axford's and Postlethwaite Hal's. Postlethwaite, the great lobber, has a weird young old face and little wet lips that lapse into a sucking reflex under stress. In theory, a big buddy's somewhere between an RA and a prorector. He's there to answer questions, ease bumpy transitions, show ropes, act as liaison with Tony Nwangi and Tex Watson and the other prorectors specializing in little kids, be somebody they can come to off the record.
A shoulder to climb up on a footstool and cry on.
If a 16 and under gets made a big buddy, it's kind of an honor. It means they think you're going places. When there's no tournament or travel, etc., big buddies get together with their core to sextet in small group private twice a week, in the interval between PM challenge matches and dinner, usually after saunas and showers, and a few minutes of sitting slumped around the locker room sucking air. Sometimes Hal sits with his little buddies at dinner and eats with them. Not often, however. The savvier big buddies don't get too overly close with their little buddy Ephebes. Don't let them forget about the unbridgeable gaps of experience and ability and general status that separate Ephebes from upperclassmen who've hung in and stuck it out at ETA for years and years. Gives them more to look up to. The savvy big buddy doesn't rush in or tread heavy. He holds his own ground and lets the suppliants realize when they need his help and come to him. You have to know when to tread in and take an active hand, and when to hang back and let the littler kids learn from the personal experience they'll have to learn from inevitably if they want to be able to hang. Every year, the biggest source of attrition, besides graduating 18s, is 13 to 15s who've had enough and just can't hang. This happens. The administration accepts it. Not everyone's cut out for what's required of you here. Though CT makes his administrative assistant, lateral Alice Moore, drive the pro-rector's bats trying to ferret out data on littler kids' psychic states, so he can forecast probable burnouts and attritive defections, so he'll know how many slots he and admissions will have to offer incomings for the next term. Big buddies are in a tricky position. Requested to keep the pro-rectors generally informed about who among their charges seems shaky in terms of resolve, capacity for suffering and stress, physical punishment, homesickness, deep fatigue, but at the same time wanting to remain a trustworthy confidential shoulder and wing for their little buddy's most private and delicate issues. Though he too has to struggle with a strange urge to be cruel to Ingersoll, who reminds him of someone he dislikes but can't quite place, Hal, on the whole, rather likes being a big B. He likes being there to come to, and likes delivering little unpretentious mini-lectures on tennis theory and ETA pedagogy and tradition, and getting to be kind in a way that costs him nothing. Sometimes he finds out he believes something that he doesn't even know he believed until it exits his mouth in front of five anxious, little hairless, plump, trusting, clueless faces. A twice-weekly, more like once-weekly, as things usually pan out, group interfaces with his quintet are unpleasant only after a particularly bad PM session on the courts, when he's tired and on edge, and would far rather go off by himself and do secret stuff in underground ventilated private. Jim Trolch feels at his glands. John Wayne is of the sock and a shoe, sock and a shoe school. Tard, Orthostice again sighs. He pronounces it tard.
To a man now, the upperclassmen are down slumped on the locker room's blue crush carpet,
their legs straight out in front of them, toes pointing out at that distinctive morgue angle, their backs up against the blue steel of the lockers, careful to avoid the six sharp little louvered anti-mildew vents at each locker's base. All of them look a bit silly naked because of their tennis tans, legs and arms, the deep sienna of a quality catcher's mitt from the summer, the tan just now this late starting to fade, but feet and ankles of toad belly white, the white of the grave, with chests and shoulders and upper arms, more like off-white. The players can sit shirtless in the stands at tournaments when they're not playing and get at least a bit of thoracic sun. The faces are the worst, maybe, most red and shiny, some still deep peeling from 3 straight weeks of outdoor tournaments in August through September. Besides Howell, who's atavistically dark-complected anyway, the ones here with the least bad piebald coloring are the players who can tolerate spraying themselves down with Lemon Pledge before outdoor play. It turns out Lemon Pledge, when it's applied in pre-play stasis and allowed to dry to a thin crust, is a phenomenal sunscreen. UV rating like 40 plus, and the only stuff anywhere that can survive a 3-set sweat. No one knows what junior player at what academy found this out about Pledge years back or how. Rather bizarre discovery circumstances are envisioned. The smell of sweat, wet, Pledge out on the court makes some of the more delicately constituted kids sick, though. Others feel sunscreen of any kind to be unconscionably pussified, like white visors or on-court sunglasses. So most of the ETA upperclassmen have these vivid shoe and shirt tans that give them the classic look of bodies hastily assembled from different bodies' parts, especially when you throw in the heavily muscled legs and usually shallow chests and the two arms of different sizes.
Tard, 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 Stice says.
Group empathy is expressed via sighs, further slumping, small spastic gestures of exhaustion, the soft clanks of skulls' backs against the locker's thin steel.
My bones are ringing the way sometimes people say their ears are ringing. I'm so tired.
I'm waiting till the last possible second to even breathe. I'm not even expanding the cage till driven by necessity of air. So tired. It's out of tired's word range, Pemula says. Tired just doesn't do it. Exhausted. Shot. Depleted, says Jim Strzok, grinding at his closed eye with the heel of his hand. Cashed. Totaled. Look, Pemulus pointing at Strzok. It's trying to think. A moving thing to see.
Beat. Worn the heck out.
Worn the fuck all out is more like. Wrung dry, whacked, tuckered out, more dead than alive.
None even come close, the words.
Word inflation, Sty says, rubbing at his crew cut so his forehead wrinkles and clears.
Bigger and better. Good, greater, greatest, totally great. Hyperbolic and hyperbolicer, like great inflation.
Should be so lucky, says Strzok, who's been on academic probation since 15. Stice is from a part of southwest Kansas that might as well be Oklahoma. He makes the companies that give him clothes and gear, give him all black clothes and gear, and his ETA cognomen is the Darkness. Hal raises his eyebrows at Stice and smiles.
Hyperbolicer? My daddy as a boy, he'd have said, tuckered out'll do just fine. Whereas here we are sitting here needing whole new words and terms. Phrases and clauses and models and structures,
Trolch says,
referring again to a prescriptive exam everyone but Hal wishes now to forget. We need inflation generative grammar. Keith Freer makes a motion as if taking his unit out of his towel and holding it out at Trolch. Generate this. Need a whole new syntax for fatigue on days like this, Strzok says. ETA's best minds on the problem. Whole thesauruses digested, analyzed. Makes a sarcastic motion. How? One semion that still works fine is holding your fist up and cracking at it with the other hand, so the finger you're giving somebody goes up like a drawbridge. Though, of course, Hal's mocking himself at the same time. Everybody agrees it speaks volumes. Idris Arslanian's shoes and incisors appear briefly in the doorway's steam, then withdraw. Everyone's reflection is sort of cubist in the wall's shiny tiling. The name handed down paternally from an Umbrian five generations past, and now much diluted by Northeast Yankee, a great-grandmother with Pima tribe Indian Southwest blood and Canadian crossbreeding. Hal is the only extant Incandenza who looks in any way ethnic. His late father had been, as a young man, darkly tall, high, flat Pima tribe cheekbones and very black hair, brill-creamed back so tight there'd been a kind of enforced widow's peak. Himself had looked ethnic, but he isn't extant. Hal is sleek, sort of radiantly dark, almost otterish, only slightly tall, eyes blue but darkly so, and unburnable even without sunscreen. His untanned feet the color of weak tea, his nose ever unpeeling but slightly shiny. His sleekness isn't oily so much as moist, milky. Hal worries secretly that he looks half feminine. His parents' pregnancies must have been all-out chromosomatic war. Hal's eldest brother, Oren, had got the mom's Anglo-Nordic Canadian phenotype, the deep socketed and lighter blue eyes, the faultless posture and incredible flexibility. Oren was the only male anybody at ETA'd ever heard of who could do a fully splayed cheerleader-type split. The rounder and more protrusive zygomatics. Hal's next oldest brother, Mario, doesn't seem to resemble much of anyone they know. On most of the non-travel days that he doesn't big buddy with his charges, Hal will wait till most everybody's busy in the sauna and shower, and stow his sticks in his locker and stroll casually down the cement steps into ETA's system of tunnels and chambers. He has some way he can
casually drift off, and have quite a while go by before anyone notices his absence. He'll often stroll casually back into the locker room just as people are slumped on the floor in towels, discussing fatigue, carrying his gear bag and substantially altered in mood, and go in when most of the littler kids are in there, peeling pledge husks off their limbs, and taking their turn showering. And shower, using one of the kids' shampoo out of a bottle shaped like a cartoon character. Then hike the head back, and apply Visine and a shocked freestall, gargle and brush and floss and dress, usually not even needing to comb his hair. He carries Visine AC, mint-flavored floss, and a traveler's toothbrush in a pocket of his Dunlop gear bag. Ted, shocked, big into oral hygiene, regards Hal's bags, floss, and brush as an example to them all.
So tired, it's like I'm almost high.
But not pleasantly high, Trulch says.
It'd be a pleasanter tiredness high if I didn't have to wait till fucking 1900 to start all this studying,
Sty says.
You think Shtit could at least not turn up the juice the week before midterms? You think that the coaches and the teachers could try and get together on their scheduling?
It'd be like a pleasant fatigue if I could just go up after dinner and hunker on down with the mind in neutral and watch something uncomplex.
Don't have to worry about prescriptive forms or acutants.
Kick back.
Watch something with chase scenes and lots of stuff blowing up all over the place.
Relax. Do bongs, kick back, look at lingerie catalogs, eat granola with a great big wooden spoon,
Struck says wistfully.
Get laid.
Just get one night off to like R&R. Slip on the old environmental suit and listen to some atonal jazz.
Have sex. Get laid.
Pump uglies. Do the nasty. Haul ashes.
Find me one of them northeast Oklahoma drive-in burger stand waitresses with the great big huge titties.
Those enormous pink-white French painting tits that sort of like tumble out.
One of those wooden spoons so big you can barely get your mouth around it.
Just one night to relax and indulge.
Pemulus belts out two quick verses of Johnny Mathis's Chances Are, left over from the shower, then subsides to examine something on his left thigh. Shaw has a spit bubble going, growing to such exceptional size for just spit that half the room watches until it finally goes at the same moment Pemulus breaks off.
Evan Ingersoll says,
"We get off Saturday for Interdependence Day, Eve, though, the board said."
Several upper-class heads are cocked up at Ingersoll. Pemulus makes a bulge in his cheek with his tongue and moves it around.
Flibble, flibble.
Stice makes his jowls fly around.
We get off classes is all. Drills and challenges go merrily on, Delint says.
Freer points out.
But no drills Sunday before the gala.
But still matches. Every junior player presently in this room is ranked in the top 64 continentally, except Pemulus, Yardley, and Blott. There'd be clear evidence that T-Shocked's still in one of the toilet stalls off the showers, even if Hal couldn't see the tip of one of Shocked's enormous purple shower thongs under the door of the stall right by where the shower area entryway cuts into his line of sight. Something humble, placid even, about inert feet under stall doors. The defecatory posture is an accepting posture, it occurs to him. Head down, elbows on knees, the fingers laced together between the knees. Some hunched, timeless, millennial type of waiting. Almost religious. Luther's shoes on the floor beneath the chamber pot, placid, possibly made of wood. Luther's 16th century shoes, awaiting epiphany. The mute, quiescent suffering of generations of salesmen in the stalls of train station Johns, heads down, fingers laced, shined shoes inert, awaiting the acid gush. Women's slippers, centurions' dusty sandals, dock workers' hobnailed boots, Pope's slippers. All waiting, pointing straight ahead, slightly tapping. huge, shaggy-browed men in skins hunched just past the firelight circle with wadded leaves in one hand, waiting. Schacht suffered from Crohn's disease, a bequest from his ulcerative colitic dad, and had to take carminative medication with every meal, and took a lot of guff about his digestive troubles, and had developed, of all things, arthritic gout, too, somehow, because of the Crohn's disease, which had settled in his right knee and caused him terrible pain on the court.
43.
Freer's and Tall Paul Shaw's rackets fall off the bench with a clatter, and Beak and Blot move fast to pick them up and stack them back on the bench. Beak, one-handed, because the other hand is keeping his towel fastened. Struck says. Pemulus loves to sing around tile. Struck's hitting his palm with a finger for either emphasis or ordinal counting. Close to, let's call it an hour run for the A squads, an hour 15 drills, two matches back to back. I only played one, Trulch injects. Had a measurable fever in the AM. Delince had to throttle down today. Folks that went three sets only played one match. Spodek and Kent, for an instance, Stice says. Funny how Trulch, how his health always seems to rally when AM drills get out, Freer says. Like, conservatively, 2 hours for the matches, conservatively, and half an hour on the machines under fucking Loach's beady browns, sitting there with a clipboard. That's, let's call it, 5 hours of vigorous, nonstop, straight-out motion. Sustained and strenuous exertion. Stitz determinated this year we ain't singing no silly songs at Port Washington. John Wayne hasn't said one word this whole time. The contents of his locker are neat and organized. He always buttons his shirt all the way up to the top button, as if he were going to put on a tie, which he doesn't even own. Ingersoll's also getting dressed out of his underclassman's small square locker. Stice says, except they seem to forget we're still in our puberty. Ingersoll is a kid seemingly wholly devoid of eyebrows, as far as Hal can see.
Speak for yourself, darkness.
I'm saying how stressing the pubertizing skeleton like this. It's real short-sighted. Stice's voice rises. I'm supposed to do when I'm 20 and in the show playing non-stop and I'm skeletally stressed and injury-prone.
Dark's right.
A curled bit of cloudy old pledge husk and a green thread from a strip of Gauze-Tex wrap are complexly entwined in the blue fibers of the carpet near Hal's left ankle, which ankle is faintly swollen and has a blue tinge. He keeps flexing the ankle whenever it occurs to him to.
Struck and Trulch spar briefly with open hands, fainting and bobbing their heads, both still seated on the floor.
Hal, Stice, Trulch, Struck, Raider, and Beak are all rhythmically squeezing tennis balls with their racket hands as per Academy mandate. Struck's shoulders and neck have furious purple inflammations. Hal had also noticed a boil on the inside of Schacht's thigh when Ted had sat down. Hal's face's reflection just fits inside one of the wall tiles opposite, and then, if he moves his head slowly, the face distends and comes back together with an optical twang in the next tile. That post-shower community feeling is dissipating. Even Evan Ingersoll looks quickly at his watch and clears his throat. Wayne and Shaw have dressed and left. Freer, a major pledge devotee, is at his hair in the mirror. Pemulus also rising now to get away from Freer's feet and legs. Freer's eyes have a protrusive wideness to them that the axe handle says makes Freer always look like he's getting shocked or throttled. And time in the PM locker room seems of limitless depth. They've all been just here before. Just like this, and we'll be again tomorrow. The light saddening outside, a grief felt in the bones, a sharpness to the edge of the lengthening shadows. I'm thinking it's Tavis, Freer says to them all in the mirror. Where there's excess work and suffering, can fucking Tavis be far behind? No, it's shtit, Hal says.
Shit was short a few wickets out of the old croquet set long before it got a hold of us, men, Pemula says.
Beamster and Hal.
Halation and Pemorama.
Freer purses his little lips and expels air, like he's blowing out a match, blowing some tiny grooming remnant off the big mirror's glass. Shtit just does what he's told, like a good Nazi.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Asks a Stice who's well known for asking, how high, sir, when Shtit says jump, now feeling at the carpet around him for something to throw at Freer. Ingersoll tosses Stice a wopsed-up towel, trying to be helpful, but Stice's eyes are on Freer's in the glass, and the towel hits him on the head and sits there, on his head. The room's emotions seem to be inverting themselves every couple seconds. There's half-cruel laughter at Stice as Hal struggles to his feet, rising in careful stages, putting most of his weight on the good ankle. Hal's towel falls off as he does his combination. Strzok says something that's lost in the roar of a high-pressure toilet. The feminized American stood at a slight angle to Marat upon the outcropping. He stared out at the dusk shadow they were now inside, and as well as the increasingly complicated twinkle of the USA city Tucson, seeming slackly transfixed steeply, in the way vistas too large for the eye to contain transfix persons in a kind of torpid spectation. Marat seemed on the edge of sleep. Even the voice of Steeply had a different timbre inside the shadow.
They say it's a great, and maybe even timeless love, Rod Tynes, for your Luria person.
Marat grunted, shifting slightly in the chair. Steeply said,
the sort that gets sung about. The kind people die for and then get immortalized in song. You got your ballads, your operas, Tristan and Isolde, Lancelot and what's-her-name, Agamemnon and Helen, Dante and Beatrice.
Marat's drowsy smile continued upward to become a wince.
Narcissus and Echo,
Kierkegaard and Regina,
Kafka and that poor girl afraid to go to the postbox for the mail.
Interesting choice of example here, the mailbox.
Steeply pretended to chuckle. Marat came alert.
Take off your wig and be shitting inside it, Hugh Steeply B.S.S. And the ignorance of you appalls me. Agamemnon had no relation with this queen. Menelaus was husband, him of Sparta, and you mean Paris, Helen and Paris, he of Troy.
Steeply seemed amused in the idiotic way.
Paris and Helen, the face that launched vessels. The horse, the gift which was not a gift. The anonymous gift brought to the door. The sack of Troy from inside.
Marat rose slightly on his stumps in the chair, showing some emotions at this Steeply.
I am seated there appalled at the naivete of history of your nation. Paris and Helen were the excuse of the war. All the Greek states, in addition to the Sparta of Menelaus, attacked Troy because Troy controlled the Dardanelle.
And Charles the Ruinous tolls for passage through, which the Greeks, who would like very dearly the easy sea passage for trade with the Oriental East, resented with fury.
It was for commerce, this war. The one quotes love, one does not quote of Paris for Helen merely was the excuse.
Steeply, genius of interviewing, sometimes affected more than the usual idiocy with Marat, which he knew baited Marat.
Everything reduces itself to politics for you guys. Wasn't that whole war just a song? Did that war even really take place that anybody knows of?
The point is that what launches vessels of war is the state and community and its interests,
Marat said without heat, tiredly.
You only wish to enjoy to pretend for yourself that the love of one woman could do this, launch so many vessels of alliance.
Steeply was stroking the perimeters of the mesquite scratch, which made his shrug appear awkward.
I don't think I'd be so sure. Those around Rod the God say the man he'd die twice for. Say he wouldn't have to even think about it. Not just that he'd let the whole O-N-A-N come down if it came to that.
But it'd die.
Marat sniffed. Twice.
without even having to pause and think,
Steeply said, stroking at his lips,
electrolysistic rash in a ruminative fashion.
It's the reason most of us think he's still there. Well, he's still got President Gentle's ear. Divided loyalties are one thing, but if he does it for love, well then, you got a tragic element that transcends the political, wouldn't you say?
Steeply smiled broadly down at Marat. Marat's own betrayal of AFR, for medical care for the conditions of his wife, for, Steeply might imagine to think, love of a person, a woman.
Tragic, saying as if Rodney Tyne of non-specificity were not responsible for choosing it.
As the insane are not responsible, said Marat quietly.
Steeply now was smiling even more broadly.
It has a kind of tragic quality. Timeless, musical. But how could Gentle resist?
Marat's tone now became derisive, despite his legendary sang-froid in matters of technical interviews.
These sentiments from a person who allows them to place him in the field as an enormous girl with teats at the cockeyed angle, now discoursing on tragic love.
Steeply, impassive, and slackly ruminative, picked at the lipstick of the corner of his mouth
with the littlest finger,
removing some grain of grit, gazing out from their shelf of stone.
But sure, the fanatically patriotic wheelchair assassins of South Quebec scorn this type of interpersonal sentiment between people.
Looking down at Marat.
No, even though it's just this that has brought you Tyne, yours for Luria to command. Should it ever come to that?
Marat had settled back on his bottom in the chair.
Your USA word for fanatic, do they teach you it comes from the Latin for temple? It is meaning literally, worshipper at the temple.
Oh, Jesus, now here we go again, Steeply said.
As if you will give the permission, does this love you speak of, Monsieur Tyne's grand love? It means only the attachment. Tyne is attached fanatically.
Our attachments are our temple,
what we worship, no? What we give ourselves to, what we invest with faith.
Steeply made motions of weary familiarity.
Here we go.
Marat ignored this.
Are we not all of us fanatics? I say only what you of the USA only pretend you do not know. Attachments are of great seriousness. Choose your attachments carefully. Choose your temple of fanaticism with great care. What you wish to sing of as tragic love is an attachment not carefully chosen.
Die for one person? This is craziness.
Persons change, leave, die, become ill. They leave, lie, go mad, have sickness, betray you, die. Your nation outlives you. A cause outlives you.
How are your wife and kids doing up there, by the way?
You USAs do not seem to believe you may each choose what to die for. Love of a woman, the sexual, it bends back in on the self, makes you narrow, maybe crazy? Choose with care.
Love of your nation, your country and people, it enlarges the heart, something bigger than the self.
Steeply laid a hand between his misdirected breasts.
Oh, Canada.
Marat leaned again forward on his stumps.
Make amusement all you wish,
but choose with care.
You are what you love, no? You are completely and only what you would die for without, as you say.
The thinking twice.
You, Monsieur Hugh Steeply, you would die without thinking for what?
The AFR's extensive file on Steeply included mention of his recent divorce. Marat already had informed Steeply of the existence of this file. He wondered how badly Steeply doubted what he reported, Marat, or whether he assumed its truth simply. Though the persona of him changed, Steeply's car for all field assignments was this green sedan subsidized by a painful ad for aspirin upon its side. The file knew this stupidity. Marat was sure the sedan with its aspirin advertisement was somewhere below them, unseen.
The fanatically beloved car of Monsieur Hugh Steeply.
Steeply was watching or gazing at the darkness of the desert floor. He did not respond. His expression of boredom could be real or tactical. Either of these. Marat said,
This, is it not the choice of the most supreme importance?
Who teaches your USA children how to choose their temple? What to love enough not to think two times?
This from a man who...
Marat was willing that his voice not rise.
But this choice determines all else, no? All other of our, you say, free choices follow from this. What is our temple?
What is the temple thus for USAs?
What is it when you fear that you must protect them from themselves, if wicked Quebecers conspire to bring the entertainment into their warm homes?
Steeply's face had assumed the openly twisted, sneering expression, which he knew well Quebecers found repellent on Americans.
But you assume it's always choice, conscious decision. This isn't just a little naive, Raimi? You sit down with your little accountant's ledger and soberly decide what to love, always?
The alternatives are...
What if sometimes there is no choice about what to love? What if the temple comes to Muhammad? What if you just love without deciding? You just do. You see her and in that instant are lost to sober account keeping and cannot choose but to love.
Marat's sniff held disdain.
Then, in such a case, your temple is self and sentiment. Then, in such an instance, you are a fanatic of desire, a slave to your individual subjective narrow self's sentiments, a citizen of nothing. You become a citizen of nothing. You are by yourself and alone, kneeling to yourself.
A silence ensued this. Marat shifted in his chair.
In a case such as this, you become the slave who believes he is free. The most pathetic of bondage. Not tragic. No songs. You believe you would die twice for another, but in truth, would die only for your alone self. It's sentiment.
Another silence ensued. Steeply, who had made his early career with unspecified services, conducting technical interviews, used silent pauses as integral parts of his techniques of interface.
44.
Here it diffused Marat. Marat felt the ironies of his position. One strap of Steeply's prosthesis brassiere had slipped into view below his shoulder, where it cut deeply into his flesh of the upper arm. The air smelled faintly of creosote, but much less strongly smelling than the ties of train tracks which Marat had smelled at close range. Steeply's back was broad and soft. Marat eventually said,
You, in such a case, have nothing. You stand on nothing. Nothing of ground or rock beneath your feet. You fall. You blow here and there. How does one say, tragically, involuntarily, lost?
Another silence ensued. Steeply farted mildly. Marat shrugged. The BSS field operative Steeply may not have been truly sneering. The city Tucson's loom appeared a bleached and ghostly white in the unhumid air. Crepuscular animals rustled and perhaps scuttled. Dense and unbeautiful spider webs of the poisonous USA species of spider black widow were beneath the shelf and the incline's other outcroppings. And when the wind hit certain angles in the mountainside, it moaned. Marat thought of his victory over the train that had taken his legs.
45.
He attempted in English to sing,
Oh, say, land of the free.
And they both could feel this queer, dry, night desert chill descend with the moon's gibbous rise, a powdery wind down below making dust to shift and cactus needles whistle, the sky stars adjusting to the color of low flame, but were themselves not yet chilled, even Steeply's sleeveless dress. He and Marat stood and sat in the form-fitting astral space suit of warmth their own radiant heat produced. This is what happens in dry night climes, Marat was learning. His dying wife had never once left southwestern Quebec.
Les assassins de Fauteuil Roulant, remote embryonic disseminatory op space down here in southwest USA,
seemed to him like the surface of the moon, four corrugated quonsets, and kiln-baked earth, an air that swam